I went with my six-year-old daughter, Phoebe, yesterday to a paint party. If you haven't been to one of these, it's at a paint studio. This one was up near Turf Valley. I had not been there before. It's called Pino's Palette. It's tempting to say Pino's Palais, but it's Pino's Palette. And you go in, and we were one of the first ones there, and there were a bunch of easels set up just ready for each of the six-year-olds to come in and find their very own canvas. So we got there, and Phoebe was excited. She was among the great group of friends that she has at her school. And you could see on the canvas was already a pre-done kind of chalking of the outline of what would be a unicorn, right? So that each of the kids can come in, and they're going to follow an instructor who's up front, who has one of those mics on her ear and is going to guide them through the process. It's like paint by number in a sense. But as you know, if you've been any part of like a collective painting process, each kid is going to make it their own, right? Especially if a six-year-old, sometimes they're not going to be paying quite the same level of attention, and they just have to have their own flourish, as I think that any one of us would, as we were presented with that temptation of that beautiful open canvas. The invitation to the parents is to sit right behind the children or right hovering about them with your own apron with the very permanent paint and to kind of hover over them in such a way if there's any question about what needs to be done or any support necessary with big globs of paint, that the parent is on hand to keep things in control. Now, this is an interesting tension because you're at the height of wanting to be creative, right, with this beautiful, magical unicorn that is being birthed on the canvas, and yet also being asked to be kind of the hawkish presence that a parent can sometimes be. Now, if you've perhaps some of you have in your background some painting and whatnot, and sometimes as a parent, it's actually a little bit more dangerous when you have some experience in something that's unfolding, right? Have you found this? Like if you're a coach and you like played years of soccer and then you're like trying to like direct your two-year-olds that are going down the field just following each other, like there's something in you that says it's not right. It's not being done correctly. So I did really well. I'm not a painter, but I certainly have spent some time in some art. And so I was, you know, I would just give a little ease from time to time of you might want a little bit more paint on your brush. Or I'd say you might just want to close up that little section, you know, because she was following along. But, you know, she was. And so I felt so good about that. But after pizza, because all these parties have pizza, after pizza, we came back and she was finishing off the art, and I did so well until the very end. Yeah, it was coming. So at the very end, what's the ultimate thing you do when you have your work of art and you've completed it and you've done all the flourishes and it's yours? You sign it. You sign it. It's yours. And so, you know, I said, all right, Phoebe, it's time to put your name on it. It's yours. You know, we'll put it on the wall. We'll know it's yours. And so I don't know if it was a pressure, but she got the teal paint and she got the brush and she started writing. And she wrote the big P. Now, Phoebe's not an easy name to spell generally, I know, right? We gifted that her name. But she has written it, remember, hundreds of times. I'm looking at Dawn because her daughter is also in Phoebe's class, and their teacher is hawkish and makes them write their names over and over and over again. So this woman has, this young lady, soon to be a woman, I know, any minute, has written P-H-O-E-B-E hundreds of times. Okay, so we got the big P. We got the H. We got the O. And then she wrote B. Now, friends, there is a P-H-O-E-B-E. And so immediately I just went over and said, oh, what are we going to do? And so I snatched the paintbrush. And I said, I kid you not, we can fix this. And I proceeded to try and, you know, make the B and E and, you know, all the tricks. And it just, it wasn't looking up to whatever my internal sense of how it needed to look. And so I said, it's okay. And then I grabbed another paintbrush and got it with a big glob of paint. And then tried to get her to assist me in erasing the whole thing that she had done. Yeah. Oh, I know. It got worse, didn't it? So, and then, of course, you know, some of the other parts of the paint were wet, so it started getting real messy and smeary in places. And I said, oh, it's okay. It's okay. And I made a spot. You could tell she was just kind of crumpling under this energy that I had suddenly given, right? This, like, sense of communicating to her that she had made a big mistake, right? And that I was mad that she wasn't able to perform in that moment. And so eventually, you know, we found a drier spot on the page, and I just already could catch myself instantaneously. The guilt was coming in. And I tried to then back off and just let her spell her name. And so that's what she did. She had her name here. You see? Yeah. Yeah. You see that name over there? This middle part of the neck was where her name was. Yeah. Yeah. The guilt was big, especially when you're thinking about something that's going to have posterity. You want it to be just right. But I was feeling that sense of rejection would be the thing that ended up having the posterity. And I knew it would for me, too. I don't know how I'm ever going to look at this unicorn and not remember what I did, right? Perhaps we know that these mistakes, seeming mistakes, linger for us. And instead of a time of creativity, the opportunity is for memories of not measuring up and the erasure of who we are in our own spirits, about who God would be calling us to be in the unique creations that we are. And I realize, too, in this moment that I am being hard on myself as a mother, but I know, likely so very much as you do, that these lessons about rejection and self-rejection soak in so early. We can so easily sense the judgment that we bring to the moment as a parent, as a mentor, as a friend, that translate into the developing of an inner self-rejection, right? And we find that Henry Nouwen, in his book that we'll be using through Lent, outlines the fact that it is self-rejection that is the number one reality that keeps us from feeling and accepted that we are beloved of God. So there's all these outside forces, but when it comes down to it, self-rejection, and of course any of the other voices that help feed into that, is the number one cause of us not feeling that sense of worthiness and that belovedness. He says, self-rejection is the greatest enemy of the spiritual life because it contradicts the sacred voice that calls us beloved. Instead of cultivating that inner voice of love over time, we become much more eager to, and I argue to become the voice boxes for, louder voices, harsher voices, that they prove that you are worth something, right? That you need to prove that you're worth something to do something relevant, spectacular, or powerful, and then you will earn the love that you so desire. Don't make mistakes. Yes, it's much harder for us to soak in the knowledge that we are God's cherished ones. And I think that is more in our more encouraging moments that we do look to Scripture and find evidence that we are in that place of cherishedness. Those words that come from Henry Nouwen that are a part of our opening, and you will see some words at the end in our sending forth, are echoes of Psalms, like Psalm 139, and also places in Isaiah that remind us that before we were even birthed into this world, in our very conception, God was alongside of us. And part of the artistry that would become our co-creation together and the beauty that we are. Or we might point to the story of Noah and the ark as devastating as it is. What happens at the end with the rainbow but a promise and a covenant? Knowing that all who fall under that rainbow, each and every living thing, is cherished. Nobody falls outside that beautiful arc of the rainbow. That includes us. Now, Nouwen is then under that presupposition you have to come to, that indeed you are beloved, wants us to deeply consider what we do with this knowledge. Because it's one thing to cognitively think it. It's one thing to try and read the scriptures and allow it to be part of your theoretical theory on life. But with Nouwen, it's always then about how that moves into the heart. In the life of the beloved, it is he who meets someone who's in the midst of their own angst in life and questioning. Henry Nouwen is serving at the point in which he meets Fred Bratman. He's serving at Yale Divinity as a Catholic priest in residence and a professor there. And Fred Bratman comes along as a New York Times journalist. And Fred Bratman is at a season in his life where he is doing what needs to be done to pay the bills. Somewhere along the way, he may have had higher aspirations in how to employ his artistry of writing in the world, but he comes doing his job. We know we meet people along the way who are there for the paycheck and getting the checks of the boxes because this is what they have to do in order to get by. And as Nouwen sat with Fred, he could sense this was true in his spirit. For even though Fred was asking the right questions about what needed to be put in the article that would go in the paper, Nouwen was very moved with a sense of this person's unhappiness in life. Something of the disgruntlement, something of the, even though he may have had a lot going for him, maybe a bit of that rich ruler who's coming and doesn't even know it. It's like if the rich ruler was coming and asking questions but didn't really even know that he wanted something more. This was Fred. And so at one point at the conclusion part of that interview, Nouwen just looks at him and has this Jesus-inspired pity. It's not pity, it's compassion, a suffering with, a sense of love, a sense of knowing that someone is created for so much more than what it is that they are currently living out. And so Nouwen then sees that, but he doesn't berate him. He doesn't start getting the paintbrush out and saying, well, here's how we can do this better, Fred. But he does think very cautiously about the kinds of self-awakening questions that he asks him. And says, what is it that is bringing you a sense of life? What is it that you really want? And remember, this is the very first time they're meeting. So Fred is thinking, who is this guy? And he got him to articulate the fact that he wanted to write a novel. And in so doing, Nouwen encounters Fred's sense of his inner negative voices, the kind of self-rejection we've been talking about. It came out and it said, what if I don't have what it takes to become a journalist? You need time, you need money, and most of all, talent, and I don't have any. Do we sometimes have dreams but don't think we have any talent to live them out? That's a long life, friends. You have a dream, but you don't feel like you have the talent to live it out. And it was then that I can only imagine that Nouwen's sense of that deep compassion swelled forth. And I think before he even realized it, he said, come and be here. I'll find some money for you. Come and live in residence at Yale Divinity, and we will make it happen. So engaged and so desirous of he was he to create a canvas for him, a place where he could come and just forget about the fact that he had to do what he had to do in order to get by. And as we know from Fred, this was a bit of an overwhelming proposition. Can you imagine? Come and live with me. Catholic priest, secular Jew journalist. He's thinking, this is a Christian seminary. I'm a secular Jew. So in a place of cynicism and his own uncertainty, Fred had to sit with that invitation, had to go back, and perhaps you've had a well-timed conversation in your past that helped you really make a fork in the road. For even if it wasn't that day, it was somewhere along that journey when they must have exchanged information, and then Fred writes the article, and then one thing leads to another, and Fred comes to Yale. And over the course of many years, they develop a friendship that becomes like this beautiful work of art that they create together. And it becomes a true friendship when roles begin to flip. This happens in our relationships with our children or with our parents, when sometimes the roles change over time. And as Henry starts off as kind of the spiritual guru and mentor, that Henry knows that he has so much to learn from Fred. He's known it from the very beginning. And so when it comes time for Fred to ask Henry and says, "You know, me and my friends, we fast-paced people living in New York City, always in the rat race. We need to hear from you. Yes, you tend to write to Christian audiences about all these scriptural things, but how can you take what it is you know spiritually and put it on a canvas so that we in my circle and the people I see living in the early 1990s, written in 1992, how is it that we can tap into this wellspring of knowledge that you have?" It's like the rich ruler coming up and saying, "I sense you have so much going on to teach me, and I know the rules about how things can come together, but tell me the words that beyond the rules. Tell me the words that go, mistakes are okay today." Mistakes are okay. Tell me the rules that go beyond. And so as a result, it then became Fred's opportunity to nudge and to go against Henry's self-rejection, because Nouwen had his own places of that inner sense of, "I'm not good enough. How can I write for that audience? You know, I'm European. I've come over. I write as a Catholic priest. How could I have the words to reach you where you need to be reached?" With enough confidence building, enough of that beloved voice that goes into that friendship, he acquiesces and comes to these words that we have in this book. And using this word, beloved, which in a lot of places in our world feels a little squishy, right? It's hard to wrap our minds around that word in particular, because it takes a long stretch for some people to even get to the point of which they were created in love, right? We hear, and you may have grown up in a religious tradition in which all of the mistakes that you've made or the anticipations of your fall are so outlined that you are nervous about even taking a step. And when it comes to a blank canvas, the level of caution is so great and you're so fearful that you're going to take a misstep that it is awfully hard to actually believe that ongoing mantra, "You are my beloved. You are my beloved." But Nouwen says it takes that. If you want to be on this journey of the spiritual journey, one that takes Jesus to Jerusalem, to the things that have to become the stretching and growing into this life, it can't be just a beautiful thought or a lofty idea that hangs above our lives to keep us from becoming depressed, but that nothing really changes. No, becoming beloved is required in the common spaces of our life and our daily existence, bit by bit by bit. That the ongoing journey we take, if we can stretch our minds and hearts to the fact that we are beloved, is to then live out that beloved into a becoming. Bit by bit by bit, closing the gap that exists between what I know myself and the countless specific realities I live out. That means that it isn't enough in theory to believe that bit about God's beloved creation. If I'm not able to allow God's love to penetrate my negative self-talk and hold love for me in the midst of my messiness and my mistakes. Because it is that love that is going to help me choose time and time again, brushstroke by brushstroke, to live as if I am fully loved. Here's the catch. To live as if I am fully loved and as if everyone else is too. Everyone else. Everything is wrapped in a single garment of destiny, we know from Dr. King. A large canvas of humble creation and beauty, and each has a name. As I was standing on the corner this week, waving with my balloon, my great theory of ideas of the joys of belovedness, how to live it out each day, it came to me. I know I'm not going to be everything to everyone. I don't expect every person to reach out their hand and wave at me. But I cannot be on that corner if everyone wasn't everything to me. I'm not going to be everything to everyone, but everyone is going to be everything to me. That's the gap that exists between the necessary starting place that I am truly loved and getting to the gaps so that when we're over someone's shoulder trying to help them along, we don't grab the paintbrush and try to do it for them. We trust the ongoing ability of a guiding word here or there, but in the dual process of learning from each other how to help people really know this word for themselves, beloved, it's not something you can get a stamp out and stamp it on somebody and say, see, you are, until it comes to their heart space and they spell it out for themselves. But they can tell, friends, children especially can tell, when you say love, if you're talking and walking that love or not. Is it something we just say? Is it some theory that floats? Is it just something that we suppose is true about God? Or do we take the time, even in difficult passages like the one we see today, to say, Jesus looked at him and loved him? Friends, Jesus is looking at us and loving us. We have a desperate need to be seen and feel this love of God. And as we go forward, just as Fred went forward that day and didn't immediately say yes to Henry's invitation to come to write the novel, which, by the way, he doesn't do right away, living into the messiness of it, we, like the rich man, have this canvas of our lives before us and are often cautious about taking that next step of adventure. We heard a couple of weeks ago from Bob, who went sailing to Antarctica, and from Marty, who's out on the Appalachian Trail. Bless him. I don't know if you're keeping up with what he's got going, but miles and miles in what feels like frozen type tundra. People that take that bull by the horns and say, I'm going to live into this canvas, into that next step. And like the rich man, we so often choose that which we know, the assets and the comfort we have built up versus the scary truths of the next step on our journeys. And we know, just like the rich man in his own life, people are watching how we respond to the love of God, how we are attentive to the choices that we make. And lastly, like the rich man, there's always a choice that comes after the seeming rejection. Can you imagine the amount of voices that were going off in his head about what you can and cannot do, who this rabbi was and who he was not, and this deep invitation that he's going to struggle with for the rest of his life, whether he took it up immediately, he's going to be figuring out how to fill and close up the gaps where he's living, right where he is, into that sense of a beloved man who looked at him beyond the law. Yes, we know that it might not have ended just the way we see it in Scripture. I like to think that there are many stories in Scripture that have the after effect. If we could write the next story for the man with the withered hand or the next step on the journey from the bleeding woman and say, aha, and then they went out and they lived into this beautiful canvas. I trust that is so for the rich man. And I trust that that is so for us each day and today, with each brush stroke that we take and with each little meal we take of bread and with the cup. We are asked to participate in this and asked to keep coming back and receiving our belovedness. And as we talk about this month, not just receiving it, but choosing it and then seeking to continue to live it out as we are a gift for the world. I invite you on this journey of Lent, friends, to join me, to join this community in filling in the gaps. so that the beloved that we speak and we seem to believe here takes shape everywhere. Takes shape immediately below us where the children are playing with so much energy I can hear right now. Takes place in our parking lot where kids are dropped off from the bus every day. Takes place at Vantage House down the road, where even at age 80 and 90, many people are living out a place of feeling of self-rejection. And the place on that corner to the lakes, beyond, to your neighborhoods, to our township, to this country, please, to this country, and to this world. We are the beloved. May we not only believe it, not only feel it, but write our names beautifully into it. Amen.